Today is Wednesday, April 30th, 2003, and it's a public hearing on House Bill 5030, Department of Human Services and Department-wide Support Services. And welcome, Clyde. I hope you got the right color shoes on today. Did you wake up this morning and decide you were not going to trip over Rosie?
Chair Winters, I put my shoes that I was going to wear by the front door this morning, so there wasn't a chance of making a mistake.
Don't they do that in Holland, you know? They set them there, zip we go. Anyway, welcome. We're continuing to hear the detailed discussion on administrative services. And with that, Clyde, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Winters. Chair Winters and members of the committee, for the record, again, my name is Clyde Psyche. I'm the Chief Administrative Officer for the Department of Human Services. And today I'd like to start on page 4-17 of the handout and give you an overview of our Office of Financial Services. This is the office that provides accounting, payroll, and collection services for the department. In the area of accounting, this would include making payments to vendors and providers, reconciling the financial statements, travel reimbursement, and also receiving payments that are made to the department. This section also plays an important role in coordinating and providing financial reports and working with our cost allocation plan, which is an important part of drawing down the federal funds, matching funds that the department accesses. In our payroll section, they're responsible for preparing and dispersing employee paychecks and also tracking employee leave time, and they also provide answers to employee questions regarding the benefits, employee benefits. On pages 4-18 and 4-19, there's some information about our financial recovery section. And this is one of our revenue-generating sections. And the units in these sections make collections on things such as overpayments of food stamp benefits and overpayments to providers. And on 4-18, 4-19, there's a list of these offices. And the projected amount that we are looking to collect this biennium is $49 million.
Oh, wait a minute. Yeah. Well, go ahead,
Ms. You have a total for 0103 of $8 million, and you're projecting that you're going to collect, between medical recovery and all of them?
Yes. Chair Winters, if you go down to close to the bottom of page 4-19, mm-hmm. There's a total projected collection amount, which is the total for all those sections put together.
Tell me, what's the basis of having the error rate in overpayments?
Chair Winters, I'm not sure I understand the question.
Well, the collection exists because of something that's happened. You've got an overpayment, so you go, you know, and I'm just wondering why we're having overpayments. If I look at TANF, is that because of the eligibility determination wasn't accurate?
Chair Winters, that's one of the factors, but there are actually a lot of other factors. Some, for instance, in the OHP, there's kind of a lag in when a person applies and when eligibility is ultimately determined. We also have people who don't provide all of the information that is required, or if they provide information, the information they're required is not at the accurate level in terms of income. And when those kinds of things come to our attention through a number of different ways, whether it's reported or some post-audits, then that's what triggers the collection process.
How much you have recovered, how much of it is owed?
Chair Winters, it varies for each of the units, and I didn't put down or get that information, but I can provide you a breakdown by unit because it does vary depending on which unit we're talking about on what percentage of the total owed is collected.
two things. One, how much is owed, what's collected, and then what is the process of those that you have not been able to collect?
Okay. We can get that for you.
That's consistent with Chair Winters' concerns about debt that is owed the state that we have not collected and how rapidly we're turning over those accounts.
On page 4-20, we have our Office of Contracts and Procurement, and I mentioned, as I mentioned earlier, 80%. Excuse me.
If I could just interrupt
for
just a moment, Clyde, if you could get that information also to Rick Rakovian, staff of the Audit and Human Service Budget Reform.
Representative Winters and Chair Winters and Representative Westland, we can do that. Not a problem.
That would be good as well.
Yes.
I'm obviously most interested in the
third party
medical payment.
Yeah, third party recovery.
Right.
Okay. As I said earlier, 80% of our budget goes out to payments in the local communities and payments to providers, client benefits, client services, and the main vehicle to make these payments is contracts. Every biennium, this unit processes about 10,000 contracts and amendments that keeps this process moving. One of the things that we've done since the consolidation is standardize our contracting templates and our standard terms and conditions. When contracts was decentralized, in other words, when each division had their own contracts unit, each unit had their own negotiation process and had a different set of terms and conditions. And it was very confusing and frustrating, I think, to contractors because although we were a department, it was like you were negotiating with seven different entities. And when you really look at it, a lot of these terms and conditions are boilerplate through the DOJ or DAT. Oh, shoot.
You've done quite well so far.
Right.
Yeah, and you got to pay for the shoot, too.
Because I shouldn't say
anything else.
Because most of those, that language is really requirements that DOJ and DAS have. Since we've centralized the contracts and procurement unit, we've been able to standardize our basic boilerplate language and our templates, and I think most of our vendors would agree that it's a lot confusing, a lot more efficient, and there's a lot less time spent negotiating those types of things.
If there's a lot less time, do you perceive in the future that there will be a lot less need for the advice and counsel of the Attorney General's office?
Chair Winters, as far as advice in terms of the standard boilerplate language, I think so, but there are also a lot of other issues that are part of legal sufficiency around how we craft statements of work and what kind of language we put in around accountability for the contractors and the products they have to desire. So I would say that we probably would spend less time around the standard boilerplate template types of language, but not possibly a major reduction in time around the actual work itself, the statements of work.
And I would also assume, Madam Chair, that probably just due not only to the size of the agency, but also in the nature of the business they're involved in, if you will, that would probably account for a lot of litigious incidents that I think you'd be required to seek assistance from the Attorney General from.
Chair Winters and Representative Westland, that's correct. And a lot of times with some of the money we receive, we also have to work in federal requirements and other kinds of things that are imposed on us that we in turn have to pass on to the contractors. And often the contractors may or may not be amenable to those requirements.
I guess I understand some of the variables, but what I'm getting at is that and unless there's been so many changes since I was over there, and I assume that there probably have been, that usually, you know, if you've got some kind of standard boilerplate. And I'm thinking that if you're contracting with individuals, let's say group homes for a specific kind of service, that whether you're in Multnomah County, whether you're in Clackamas County, whether you're in Klamath County, the services that you are contracting for are basically the same.
Chair Winters, I think in some cases that's correct, but I think, as Representative Westland stated earlier, one thing I've learned in the department since I've been there is that no matter how much, maybe on the surface, things look the same, there are just little idiosyncrasies and twists and requirements that come up that, to some extent, I think we can achieve what you're talking about, but there are typically other issues that crop up during the process of writing the statements and the negotiations that require consulting with the Department of Justice.
We're both looking a little puzzled, and I can understand some deviation. But I cannot, if you're talking about the kinds of services that that are pretty much standard. Mm-hmm. And I think in boilerplate contracts, you can have the standard. And then if you're having to deviate, you know, to something that's special, then that's, and I don't know how frequent the special issues crop up.
Yeah, I let me clarify, Chair Winters.
Away from what I know that's been going on is that the AG has begun, the agencies have gone to the AG for everything, and to where the AG, in some respects, is managing the operation of agencies. And so, you know, if you're talking boilerplate, and if staff knows that not everything that they have to do they need to go to the AG's office for, and
Right, and Chair Winters, I probably give you the wrong impression, but to the extent possible, I think you're right. Every chance we get, we try to standardize the language, especially for those kinds of repetitive services. And in a lot of cases, we work with the AG and have actually been given, I guess, I'm not sure what the proper terminology is, but exemptions from legal sufficiency review altogether because they put the template and the boilerplate together. They've seen it once, and they say, as long as you're using this template and boilerplate, including the services, we don't need to see it.
That's
so,
what I mean.
Yes. I'm sorry I wasn't clear.
And Madam Chair, Clyde, didn't you tell me in a private conversation that you guys are very reluctant to call the agency ever since that mean old Pete Shepherd showed up over there?
What?
That mean old Pete Shepherd.
Chair Winters and Representative Westland, can I take the Fifth Amendment while I'm up here testifying? Can I invoke the Fifth?
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The estimated collection of $49 million in 2003, where does that reappear in your financial statements, and how do you budget for that as a recovery in the 05 budget?
Senator Winters and Chair Winters and Senator Morse, I'm not sure that once we collect it what the path of that money is, and if I could, maybe I will ask Margie Johnson, who's in the audience, who is part of our budget shop, maybe to answer your question.
Welcome, Margie.
Chair Winters, members of the committee, my name is Margie Johnson, and I'm the assistant, the acting assistant director for finance and policy for the agency. When the budget is built, we make assumptions about all of the revenue sources that we would anticipate. So, for example, with the various recoveries that Clyde's shop is responsible for collecting, we track those, we look at our history, and we make assumptions about how much we're going to recover in support of the next biennium's budget. So then we build that into the budget, and depending on the program that the revenue is collected in support of, then it goes back to those accounts and appears as another fund revenue revenue recovery, if you will, which offsets the cost to the general fund of operating the program. That's a general description of how we would handle it.
Do you have a follow-up question?
I was just wondering where we would see that in documents, or you're dealing with net numbers in your budget then?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, we would identify all of the other fund revenue accounts, and the detail that is presented in the budget does have those revenue that detail by revenue source.
In other funds?
Yes.
Yeah. Thank you.
And I'm assuming broken down by the categories that you have identified.
That's correct.
Right. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Margie. The other area where we have really worked hard to consolidate is the management of some of our office equipment, things like copiers, faxes, mail machines. Prior to consolidation, if you went into one of our field offices, each one of our divisions in a particular office had their own copier, their own mail machine, and their own fax machine. So it wasn't unusual to go into an office in a rural county which maybe had 20 to 30 staff people and find four copiers, four fax machines, four mail machines in that office building. And we've really worked hard over the last couple of years to look at what our office needs are based on what our staffing is and then try to achieve efficiencies. And the one place I think we've been successful on that to a great extent has been in copier costs. And right now we're anticipating that in this biennium we'll probably save about $240,000in our copier expenses because of some of the streamlining and consolidation.
$240,000.
Right. That's correct, Representative Smith.
A question on the recovery. How many staff, how many FTEs are there in order to carry out the recovery function?
Chair Winters, at this point in time, we have 77 people in our recovery unit. And it breaks down per person on an average, just in a simple math average, to about $640,758 collected per person.
How much is the salary and benefit cost for the 77?
Chair Winters, I don't have that with me, but we can certainly get that for you. They're at a variety of different classifications and levels. So we can certainly provide that for you.
Thank you.
On beginning on page 4-22, there's the overview for our Office of Communications. With an organization of 9,000 employees and all the providers and stakeholders we have, communication is really an important part of the work we do. And typically, in any organization, when you find problems and you track back to where the problems originated, it usually was because of a lack of communication. Either the communication or information had not been timely or wasn't accurate or was not clearly understood by its intended audience. This is one area, and we are going to be providing some more detailed information that Senator Morse asked for yesterday as far as staffing levels and the before and after picture. But just as an example, in our media relations unit, this is the unit that responds to inquiries from the media and provides information to the public and provides those kinds of functions. Prior to consolidation, each division had its own media relations people. So we had 7 media relations people in the department, and today we have 3. So we've been able to gain enough efficiencies to reduce that function, as a specific example, Senator Morse, by 4 FTE. The other area that this office is responsible for is our website, which during an average month or average year, I should say, we average about 5 million hits on our website. And one of the things we have come to realize is that the web is a very effective communication tool as far as providing timely information and is a very cost-effective way to communicate with people. Should I wait?
You just lost your audience.
Yeah. Was it something I said?
Can we all run?
You're the most senior.
You might want to pause for a moment.
I'll do that, Senator Gordley.
Yes. You know, I would just comment here, and I know that my colleagues appreciate it. What happens in this process sometimes with members having dual responsibilities and being called and out has got to appear and is so disrespectful to those who come to testify before us. So just bear with us.
Sure. I appreciate that, Senator Gordley, but I also know that the demands on your time and the types of things you're faced with. So.
Thank you, and particularly the demands on our chair.
Yes.
Thank you.
She's just...
I understand completely.
We were all ready to run, too. We didn't know what we're running for.
Well, I probably need to explain. With the new committee on audit and trying to work through some of the Oregon health plan and trying to make sure we're scheduling night meetings with the stakeholders, and so Ben and I are just kind of like feeling this to confirm all these meetings that we're having to work and do.
Would you like me to continue?
Sorry.
Okay. On page 4-25, we have the overview for our Office of Facilities. And this is the office that is responsible for managing our office throughout the state, including the Human Resources Building here in Salem and the Portland State Office Building. Their responsibilities lie in the area of lease management and facility management. Here, this is another area that since we've consolidated, we have what are called project managers who work with each of the local areas to meet their facility needs. And since we've consolidated this unit, we've reduced our project management staff by 6 positions. One of the things that happened in the past is that each division had their own project managers. So if we were building a building in Medford, and we had 4 divisions who were going to be in that building, we sent 4 project managers down to be in on those local meetings in Medford, Ontario, or Ben, or wherever that would have been. At this point in time, we assign 1 project manager, and we have 1 person who is responsible for it for all of our clusters or divisions. And that really has led to a savings for us as far as travel and also staff time.
Now let's see if I understand. You now, instead of having 7 project managers, you have 1?
No. Chair Winters, I think we probably have about 5 or 6, but since we've consolidated, we've come down from about 11 or 12 to that current figure.
So you've reduced from 11 or 12 down to about 5. And in looking at facilities, in addition to those issues that are involved in whether you're talking about remodeling and some of those, kinds of issues, you also have to, your person has to interface or work with the Department of Integrated Services because they have overall the facilities responsibility.
Chair Winters, that's correct. We really don't hold any leases. The Department of Administrative Services holds the leases, and our staff primarily serves as the coordinator with our program people and works with the Department of Administrative Services. In other words, if we're designing a building in Medford, our person is responsible for bringing all the members of our staff who represent the local SDA and facility issues, as well as any partners or other people who may be involved, and working with them to kind of, where are we going to site the building? What's the design going to look like? They then coordinate all the data hookups, and they also take care of the telecommunications for the building.
I guess that raises the question as to what your future plans are for siting new buildings and some of those issues that you, whether you are, and where are they? That would then say what your staffing needs might
be. Chair Winters, what we're looking at now is as much as possible, as we have leases come due, the first thing we're looking at is can we stay in the existing facility and just extend the leases, because typically when we stay in existing facilities, because most of these leases that are coming due are probably 10, 15 years old, they're usually the rate we're charged is below market, what the current market rate would be. So as much as possible, we're trying to stay in our current facilities. So you're right. At some point in time, we will probably look at our staffing again and say...
What I would like to hear from you is your facilities plan that includes, when your leases are going to
sure.
be up, what your plans are, whether or not you're planning to do renews, or whether in the case, based on the mapping that mm-hmm. the agency was doing in order to talk about the service integration,
right.
whether or not in that mapping you do have some plans of maybe not renewing those leases mm-hmm. and going someplace else, and if you do, what it's going to cost.
Sure, we can do that. Chair Winters, would you like it for the upcoming biennium year?
It for the 2003-2005, and in fact, I think probably as far out as your planning has taken you, because inside of, when we did the reorg, a part of the
sure.
reorg was that mapping, so that that when facilities, when leases were to be renewed, and if in the planning that the current facility was not within the geographical location of where the biggest needs were, that the agency were then to pursue, maybe perhaps, if it's feasible, to occupy the staff where the needs are, and that we weren't going into facilities to satisfy the needs of staff,
sure.
but to satisfy the needs of the community and the service
right.
services that were necessary. So, this mapping was to be completed some time ago.
Mm-hmm.
If you had that mapping done, it would be very helpful if we had that information.
Sure. We could provide that for you, Chair Winters. Typically, we start looking at buildings 2 years before lease expiration, because that's typically what it takes. And just as kind of an aside, using the geomapping actually has been a very helpful tool in a number of different ways. One of the ways we found it's been helpful in the metro area is that it's also kind of given us some insight into where our clients were and their access to public transportation. And in areas where we find there's a gap as far as where bus stops are located, et cetera, we've actually gone to TriMet and negotiated bus stops that are closer for our client group, where the clients are grouped, so they can access public transportation easier. There's a brief overview of, or an overview of our Office of Information Services on page 427. When I'm done with the other offices, John Cuddy, who is our Chief Information Officer, will be presenting on that. So I would like to now move to the Office of Human Resources, which begins on page 4-29. And this is, most people know Human Resources as the Personnel Department. These are the people who are responsible for the labor relations work, recruitment and retention of staff, compensation and classification, affirmative action, safety and health, and also management of workers' compensation claims. This office is also responsible for contract negotiation, and in the department we have six labor agreements, the largest being the labor agreement with the State Employee International Union, SEIU, which used to be Oregon Public Employees Union, OPEU, and they have about 6,600 members in the department. The other office within Human Resources is our Criminal Record Check Office.
Mike, yes. There was an issue that was raised in one of my other committees this morning that suggested there had been some increases in racial harassment. Has there been any in Human Services?
Chair Winters, I am not aware that we have had a significant increase, but I will certainly look at the actual cases of suits and get that information back to you. But in my discussion with our human resources staff, and typically when we have those kinds of issues, they typically rise to my level, and it's an area I want to be stay informed on. I have not seen, you know, a significant increase or an increase.
That because there is some concern as to the risk management assessment is the issue surrounding
right.
it. So if you could get that and give me that information, whether there has been an increase and whether or not it's just for future planning.
Sure, Chair Winters, I'd be happy to do that. Our criminal record check unit performs over 200,000 checks on employees, providers, and volunteers each year. This is a very important function because it really is our last line or one of our primary lines of defense in screening out people who may pose a threat to clients in the department. Before consolidation, each division had their own separate policies, procedures, and standards on the way they qualified or disqualified people based on their criminal record. And since consolidation, we've been able to move to a department-wide standard so that people are treated the same no matter where in the department they're applying to be a provider or an employee for the DHS. Our newest office is the Office of Forms and Document Management, and their overview starts on page 4-32 of the handout. And they're an office that just, we actually just formed this office in February of 2002, so they are fairly new. Functions within that office include working with staff in the area of forms development, printing, distribution of forms, language translation, including Braille. This unit is responsible for entering the Medicaid provider claims and is also the office that is responsible for the imaging piece of the Oregon Health Plan process. And again, this is one office that there are a couple of factors involved in this. One, they've gone through some process improvement exercises and really looked at the way they were doing business and the conversion part of the process from imaging to from a paper driven process to an imaging process. Since the office was formed in 2002, we've been able to reduce our staffing level from 53 positions to 37 positions.
How many forms do you have?
I had that researched last night because you asked that yesterday, Chair Winters. And I was a little surprised by this myself. The estimate they were able to give me was about 3,100 forms in the department prior to this office being formed. As of today, we have about 2,700 forms, and what they've really kind of tried to do is look for opportunities to consolidate forms. And the other efficiency I think we're gaining is that anytime we had some kind of an initiative, every division felt they had to have their own form to support it. And more what we're looking at is instead of having seven different forms to provide the same function, why don't we have a department form that serves the purpose for everyone?
Some things never change in this building. I was just sharing with Ms. Baker that when Governor Straub was here, there was this huge program across the state of forms management. In fact, there's a form management organization.
Oh, no.
That does exist. That in order to reduce, I'm talking a lot of years ago, mm-hmm. to reduce the amount of forms that exist in this building. And so it's one of those pride of authorship issues.
Yes.
Everyone thinks that they know how to do a form better than everybody else, and then in the process, it sends the poor public up the wall.
Yes.
with all the duplications and overlap that exist, and farm management is actually a good thing. Mm-hmm. I would think that the agency might have a policy of thou shalt not create a farm unless I get approval from the central office. It's just...
How many forms would you have to fill out to get that?
That's my... you just don't do it down in the branch offices.
Right.
But it's a huge... And it's actually a huge cost driver. Jeez.
It is.
It's a huge cost driver. Yes. By the time you take the time to fill them out and the time to design them, Senator Gordley.
Thank you. The discussion kind of reminds me of, you have to be a Star Trek fan to appreciate this, but the episode about the Tribbles.
Yeah.
But moving on, I do note that on the administrative services chart, you have in parentheses that the area is new, but also that additional sections may form. Could you speak to that?
When this, and actually we do need to update this organizational chart, and I'm glad you picked that up, Senator Gordley. When the organizational chart that's in the packet was formed, we were in the process of deciding whether or not we were going to move the section that handles the Medicaid provider claims. And at that point, it sat in the Office of Medical Assistance Programs. It was, they called it, I think, the data entry unit. At that time, we were still deciding whether or not we were going to move that unit into forms and document management. One of the reasons we did that is because at this point in time, they enter these claims on a system that's called the Tartan system, which is a very old system. The only way we can get parts for that system is to go on the internet and find people who have old machines and are scavenging. The only way we can get parts is to really scavenge parts, and we have to be very creative. What we're looking at now is that, and the other piece, let me just say, the other piece is it's a double entry system, and that system was designed that way because that was kind of their way to reduce errors. So in other words, every claim has to be data entered twice, and that was kind of their quality control, one of the quality control measures. What we're looking at now is trying to move that process into an electronic process using either imaging or OCR, which is optical character reader, which I don't know a lot about, but it's one where the forms are electronically scanned, and that's how the payments are made. And so in the end, we decided we would move that in there because we wanted to combine that with the imaging group and see if we could find efficiencies and move away from the Tartan system. And we really are looking still at other areas in the department where we believe that some form design work is still being done. So it's because they're a fairly new office, that process is still going on.
And so follow-up, Madam Chair, then we are to understand that there will not be the addition of other sections to carry out this work. And you also said earlier that you had removed, I guess it would be four positions from the...
I think it was...
Down to 37?
Yeah, 50, from 53.
Oh, I'm sorry,
yes.
53.
Yes.
To
57. Right. And the other thing, Chair Winters, Senator Gordley, is that we're still not sure how much more efficiency we're going to be able to gain by moving from the manual process to a fully functional imaging process. And so potentially there could be other efficiencies and other staff savings as we move away from some of our more manual processes to more electronic processes.
Is this thank you, Madam Chair. Is this a function of the forms and document management that has been opened up for outside review? Have you had outside consultants looking at how you might gain other efficiencies in this operation?
Chair Winters and Senator Gordley, we've had both internal and external people come in to take a look at our entire, actually now we're looking at the entire OHP processing process to see what efficiencies can be gained in that area.
Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, of the three departments, you know, communication, information services, and forms and document management, there's some interesting distribution of activities. The statement on page 432 that the Office of Forms and Document Management provides electronic data management services for DHS. That's in that one department. And then you have your website development in your communication department. And then you have computer resource management in your IS department. It seems to be kind of a strange distribution of activities.
Chair Winters and Senator Morris, the computer resource management section is primarily the people who operate our mainframe, which is located in the Employment Department building. And so it's a very technical work, and so that's why it's located in the Office of Information Services. In the Office of Communications, really what they're responsible as far as the web is concerned is more kind of the web design and content. All the technical pieces around the web stuff still resides in our Office of Information Services. And in as far as the imaging system, while the forms and document management people actually handle the work itself, the technical work around the imaging systems and the equipment and the software and everything is still handled out of our Office of Information Services.
Senator Moore.
Well, that's an explanation, but it doesn't make much sense.
Okay. Chair Winter, Senator Morris, maybe as John makes his presentation around information services, we can provide more clarification for you.
Sure. Thank you.
Yes. if Senator Winters and members of the committee, if there are no Chair Winters, excuse me.
I have one further question, and you can think about it and get back to me later. And as a manager of your operation, what are the five reports that you use to manage your organization?
Chair Winters, managers in general or
you personally?
Personally.
What are the five reports that you must have to manage your organization on a day-to-day basis?
Okay. There are a number of reports I use, but I'll get back and pick the top five and get that back to you. That's a good question.
And so that I alert everyone who comes before the body, that question will be asked to all of you. This morning we're inundated with just tons and tons and tons of documents, and I think that probably that we're plowing through a lot.
Sure.
And we probably have four or five pieces that you guys use to manage. So.
Sure. Okay. Again, Chair Winters and members of the committee, if there are no further questions, I'd like to have John Cuddy, who is our Chief Information Officer, come up and do the presentation on our Office of Information Services.
John was up here, and then he just walked right back in the back of the room.
I had to get my stuff.
Well, good afternoon. My name is John Cuddy, as Clyde said, and I'm the Chief Information Officer for the department. I'm going to get my money out. DHS, OIS, CIO, BITS, BITES, MMIS, Access, Trax, ORCA, Express, TWIST.
PICS.
There's that one's not mine. In fact, I was thinking about this and the difficulties it is when you're talking about information technology to speak English. So I would ask you, if I don't speak English, to please make sure I do.
That's at least
the other thing.
Spot.
Pardon?
It's at least a 20 spot.
Yeah, that's right, at least. The other thing I did from 2 years ago is I pulled out just to wave at you 17 pages of acronyms, most of which apply to information technology, that we gave one of the committees 2 years ago. So it's an interesting challenge to try to translate this stuff for non-technical folks and non-technical managers in the department so they can understand what we're up to and try to do it in a way that they can follow. What I'd like to do, if it's okay, is just sort of walk through this document that you're receiving, and I'll try to do some of the preliminary stuff fairly quickly because I know you're going to want to spend time on the Medicaid Management Information System Replacement Project and some of those kinds of things, and which we have a policy package for, as I'm sure you know. And I'd like to spend some time with you talking about some of the challenges that we face, and that's a little further into the document. I think if I leave you with any two major things, they are what, apart from the specifics about some of those projects and things like that, they are the two things that are on the very first page. What information services does in the department is absolutely critical to the department's operations. In any organization of any size in this day and age in the United States, and probably in most of the world, information technology is absolutely critical to its operations, and if its information technology doesn't work very well, it either has major problems or is dead in the water. And the second thing that I'd want to leave with you is a bit of an understanding, I hope, of how large and complex this whole thing is. And so starting at the top about how essential information technology is first of all, like most of these shared services, I call them, or administrative services, this is not a program in itself. Its work is derivative of the work that the department does. So if we want to talk about what levels of resources we want to place into information services in the department, the first part of that conversation really has to be, what are the programs that the department operates, and how do we want to support them with automated and with automation or information systems? And so you can't really very easily talk about this out of the context of what the department does in the way of programs. And one of the examples that I use is that if we, and this is a bad example because it's purposefully a bad example because it is so much federally funded, but if there were decisions made to take the food stamp program and cut the number of food stamp recipients in this state in half, we would not be able to cut in half the number of people who operate the food stamps information system because we still have to operate a system to support the delivery of food stamps in the state of Oregon. And so it would only be that if a major piece of the food stamp program were to be cut out in such a way that we could then reduce the staff that operates that particular piece, or if Oregon went out of the food stamp business entirely, then we could stop operating a food stamp system and reduce the resources that are used to support that. So I think that's an important thing for all of us to understand, that this isn't proportional and you can't keep sort of thinning the soup. It doesn't mean to say that there aren't ways we can try to work it. I'll try to mention a few of them to in times of tight budgets to reduce resources and save on things, but it's not as simple as saying let's cut the food stamp program in half and therefore let's get rid of half of the people and the other things that support that. And I think the other point here is, and as I've said in the paper here, information technology really touches every corner of the department. And there, and I'm going to give you some statistics here in a few minutes to give you some sense of the number of programs that we support, or the number of computer programs that we operate, and that sort of thing. But it really, we help do eligibility and case management. We help with benefit issuance and provider payments. We support vital statistics and a bunch of stuff up in public health and that operation in Portland. We report to you all and to the federal government, which helps us obtain our federal match and gives them statistical information that they need to monitor the operation of many of our programs. And we produce information internally that helps the managers of the department manage the place. So, and then as far as large and complex goes, it's not surprising. The Department of Human Services is the largest and most complex agency in state government. And it's therefore not surprising that information services would reflect that size and that complexity. Several people, I think, yesterday talked about the move toward consolidating these shared services in the department, and information systems, information services was one of the first. We started in January of 96. We brought 7 very diverse data processing shops that were in the, serving the divisions of the department together at that time. And since then, we've had several rounds of additional consolidation where we've had people out in the field doing work that we've brought under the information services umbrella and some other people who were supporting systems outside of us. The key thing that I want to tell you about all this, again, is that the program set our priorities. I don't set our priorities. I try to provide a service to the programs, and the priorities that I operate under are set by those programs and are really driven by the business needs of the department. They're not driven by me. And I'll tell you something. I've over the years, have had a number of different jobs related to information technology. I've spent about half of my career in the private sector and about half of it in the public sector. This is the third state I've worked in. And I have been as a top executive in human services agencies in other states. I've had information systems reporting to me. And I've gotten real tired of these people who I call them the priests in the temple or the keepers of the mysteries or something. They kind of sit here and they say, well, let's see, John, we'll decide whether we'll let you do this with your information systems because we've got all the knowledge and we'll keep it to ourselves. And one of the things that I vowed I would do when I came here to create this Office of Information Services in this department was I would not have us behave that way. And so we try to work closely with our customers and with the programs as we define business needs and as we translate those into options for how to do automation and how to serve those business needs with technology. And the stuff specifically that drives this are things you all do. When you pass laws or make changes in programs, we have to respond with changes in information systems. Our customers inside the agency and sometimes outside have changes in business practices and improvements that they want to put in to help them operate more effectively, provide better services to clients, and so on. And then, unfortunately, none of us like it, but the federal government drives a lot of this. Clyde, I think, did you mention HIPAA? I'm going to talk about HIPAA. Whoops, there's one of them. In a few minutes, or a little while, I should say, not in a few minutes. And that's one of the main ones. That's basically is an unfunded mandate that's come from the federal government that's going to cost us millions and millions to comply. And there's been a whole series of those over the years. So we do have a lot that's driven by them. Moving to the top of page 2, one of the things that we've got in our department, and we're slowly moving away from this, but it's been definitely a problem for us for the last 6 or 7 years, is we have a non-standard technical environment. And I don't propose to go into a lot of detail about that, but let me just tell you that when those 7 different data processing shops were serving the divisions, they made their own decisions about what to use in the way of technology. They bought their own PCs. They put their own software on their own personal computers. They made decisions about what tools to use for development of systems and stuff like that. And so we inherited all this stuff. And one of the ways that I put it is we had 7 different DP shops going in 8 different directions. Or another way I put it was you name it and we've got it. And so we have been busy trying to squeeze that variability out of our technical structure in the department. For instance, when I came, I think we had about 400 or 500 Macintosh computers. I think we're down to about 30 or 40 now. And there's nothing wrong with Macintoshes. I've used them at home. But in a big networked environment, they're a problem. So what happens, though, when you have all this variation, it is very expensive and difficult to support all this stuff. And your information systems aren't as reliable as they should be because of all this variation. And I just want to give you one concrete example that I've used for the last year or two. We've got a fellow who's based in LeGrand who services desktop PCs and around and actually in 3 counties, and then that part of the state moving around 3 counties is pretty big as far as travel. He carries with him 10 CDs, each of which has a so-called desktop image. That's the the set of software that goes on the desktop PC. Because when he goes out into those field offices around those three counties, he doesn't know what he's going to encounter because of different divisions had different ways they set up their personal computers in their offices. And so he has to pull out one of those 10 CDs, hopefully finding a desktop image that's close or exactly the same as the one that he's trying to fix. Just a concrete example of how that complexity makes it difficult for our people, at least on our personal computers, to keep them running and to fix them. Another big problem we have, because we don't have a standard technical environment, is that our ability to share data across our systems is difficult. And I'm going to talk to you some more about that as I get a little further into that, or into this, I should say. But that's a real problem for us, is all of those information systems and the data that's in them were developed in those so-called stovepipes or silos historically for sometimes 30 years. And now we're in a situation where we want to try to bring this stuff together to serve a more integrated view of human services, and it is extremely difficult. And as I said, I'm going to try to give you some a little more specifics on that and some examples a little later. Many of our systems, as I just said, some of them are 30 years old. They're mainframe systems, a lot of them. They are poorly documented. They're complicated to maintain because of that. They've been patched and repatched and patched again over the years. One of the reasons, then we'll talk about this, that we need to replace our MMIS system is that it was brought into Oregon from another state about 20 years ago, and it was set up for fee-for-service. And, of course, 9 or 10 years ago when the Oregon Health Plan began and the department and the program moved to a big emphasis on managed care, this system wasn't adequate to handle that. It still isn't. It was kind of jury-rigged 9 or 10 years ago in order to make it handle managed care, but it doesn't do a very good job. And it's a perfect example of the problems that we encounter with a lot of these old 20, 30-year-old systems. They're just not able to handle the business needs in today's human services environment.
Can you be a bit more specific as to the specific problems that you encounter with going from fee-for-service to managed care?
Madam Chair, if you don't mind, we're going to have somebody from OMAP come up and talk to you about the about that thing. And if is it okay if we wait a bit? I'm not sure I can answer that very well.
Well, yes, that's fine. But when you throw out that there's problems, I think we like to know what
sure.
they are, and that would be most helpful.
We can certainly address that as we get a little further and we start talking about the MMIS system and the replacement project, if that's okay. Because of the way these systems were developed in their program silos, so to speak, the systems today that we have are interfaced, and that is that data is shared across them, but they're not really integrated. And therefore, we have these separate systems, and we try to share data, and sometimes that doesn't work very well. Because of differences in the way data is defined and things like that. We have a number of newer systems that we've either have developed or are in the midst of developing. I've mentioned a few of those when I did my acronyms like FACES and TRACS and ACCESS and those. And those are what are called client-server systems, and they add a lot of additional capability over and above those mainframe systems, and they tap into those mainframe systems and still for data and still rely on those mainframe systems sort of in the background to some extent. So we've done some things that make it easier to get at some of that data and easier for people using the systems to use them to serve clients, but it's still it's not. We still have these clunky old systems in the back. Part of that interfacing we do is external, and we have, and I just listed a few, some of them here. We connect with DMV, LEDS, Child Support, the Internal Revenue Service, the Employment Department, Medicare, counties, health plans. We have shared data with all those and others. Just some examples of that.
For those of you who don't know, LEDS is law enforcement.
Mm-hmm. Law enforcement data system, I think it is.
That's why we have Rosie sitting up there, because, you know, we talk to ourselves and we don't recognize that sometimes both people in the audience and we have new individuals on this panel, but that's for
in case you do not know what the...
My apologies, Madam Chair. I will try to.
I just happen to be an old-timer. That's the only reason I know.
Thank you.
$21.
What, $21?
Yeah.
Yes, 21. She's keeping count.
Are you counting? Uh-oh. I'm in trouble. You know, one of the things we do in our organization is we sponsor a Toastmasters Club because I think it's really important that our people know how to speak, and it's important that they know how to speak to our customers when they're talking to them about how we're planning a system or how it's going to operate or doing what we call walkthroughs of the systems and that sort of stuff. And so we sponsor a Toastmasters Club, and they count us, as some of you may know. And so it's sometimes embarrassing for me when I end up speaking because in a group of our people, because somebody will be out there in the audience, they'll come up to me after and they'll say, John, do you know you did 25 us in that? So I'm being counted again, I see. Let's see, where was I? Well, just a lot of the work we do, we really do by means of formal projects. And we've made a significant investment in training a lot of our people to be good and to be project managers and to do a good job of formal project management. Those of you who've either been around a while or read the papers, 7 years ago or so, remember DMV and our department. Thankfully, it happened before my watch here, but our department had a child support system that went belly up, and there was another one in employment. And as a result of that, the Department of Administrative Services, and I want to take my hat off to them because they put together a project management training program, which is very good, and we've really taken advantage of that. And I strongly believe that that's one of the main reasons why we haven't had big failures since then, because of that investment in professional project management. And we've really gotten into that in a significant way. And what it does is it lets us use these standard methodologies to do a much better job of controlling our projects. And I know the chair asked Clyde what some of the reports were that he used, and I'll mention one of them now, and that is we have every week on Monday morning we have our various projects, and they're not just developing new systems. They may be installing a new piece of software at every personal computer around the state or something like that. We have a Monday morning project update, and we sort of stagger them, so they're not every week, but our top management staff goes to those meetings, and those project managers sit down and tell us where they are, what their issues are, what we need to work on, and what they're having problems with, and that sort of thing. So that's a verbal report that we get, but it's on a regular weekly basis. Another thing I want to mention is because of these projects, particularly our development projects, our staffing levels fluctuate. And so at any given point in time, the people that we have working on information technology in our department consist of permanent employees, limited duration employees, temporary employees, and contractors. And so it really does go up and down depending on where we are, what stage we are in particular projects. And I think that's important for me to mention to you. Another thing that I want to also say at the bottom of page 2 is that we're pretty heavily involved in a lot of work that the state as a whole is doing for the so-called enterprise. And that is, for the first time in my pushing 9 years here, I really have seen out of the Department of Administrative Services some over the last couple of years some really good leadership on trying to move us toward a more statewide view of information technology, to look at ways we can work together, to look at things that can be done from a statewide perspective at less cost and better service. And one of the things that we participate in, Jim Neely, who talked with you yesterday, and I are members of the Information Technology Executive Committee, so-called ITEC, and I'm a member of the Chief Information Officer Council, and those both are working on statewide standards. They are working on state policies. There's a state technology plan that was put together under the auspices of all that, and it's pretty valuable stuff. And I want to tell you that, as I said, it's the first time in my time here that we've really gotten serious about stuff where I think there's a big opportunity to make a difference both in service and in cost. One of the things that we're doing, a subcommittee of the Chief Information Officer Council, is what we call the Data Center Study Project. And I have the pleasure, privilege, whatever the right word is, of chairing that subcommittee. And we are looking at the at the data centers in the state. And we're going to look at whether there are some opportunities to consolidate them, possibly outsource them. And we've got a project that we're just getting underway now. We're expecting to have a plan done in a couple of months, and then we're going to take about a year to really look at those options seriously from a cost and a service and a backup and a disaster recovery and that sort of stuff, security perspective. One of the problems we have is two of the data centers for the Department of Transportation and for DAS itself are in the fourth floor of the Revenue Building, and that's not a very secure building. Ours, as I think Clyde mentioned, our computer center is over in the Employment Building, same problem, not a very secure building. So we're going to take a good look at that stuff and see what we can do.
John, in what respect is the Employment Division not a secure building?
Madam Chair, anybody can walk in that door and go right up to the fourth floor and be within a door of our mainframe.
Really? Last time I was over there, it was...
Yeah.
As a public official, getting both in your building and getting in the Employment Division was an act of Congress.
Well, now our building is a little different.
I went over to visit the Employment Division. I think Employment Division was one of the first, if it's the one down the street, who started putting in systems so that the public couldn't get in. So I'm kind of curious as to
Madam Chair, all I can tell you is the last time I was over there, I don't know, a few weeks or a month ago, I just walked right up to the fourth floor.
They probably recognized you.
Maybe. Fair enough. But that's what I mean by it not being very secure. Okay. Page 3, I just put together some data, and I don't propose to talk about all of this, but I want to mention that we have 13 million lines of that old clunky mainframe computer code that I mentioned that runs on those mainframes. That's a lot of stuff to keep going. Our mainframe operation and our central computer center operation operates 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. We have about 5.7 million online transactions that go into that computer center every day from all over the state. Every month we produce about 580,000 checks and vouchers. We have more than 500 network connections. We have 9,500 personal computers, again, scattered all over the state.
If you were to look at a private company, what company would you think would fit into the information systems activity that would be comparable to what you do in human services?
That's a very good question, Madam Chair, and I don't have an answer. I don't know. It's pretty big.
Would it be the banking industry? I mean, I'm...
Oh, I thought you meant in terms of size. I'm sorry.
No, I'm looking at when you're talking about processing information.
Banking,
you know,
insurance,
what,
maybe?
What in the private sector would be comparable
banking,
to...
Banking, maybe, insurance, perhaps.
Senator Morris.
Thank you. It's my understanding that HP manages all of the business functions for Ford Motor Company. That would be an example.
For Hewlett Packard.
Yeah.
Do you get to pay your fees?
Oh, man. I've gone a long time without doing that. Great car.
I ask that because sometimes I think we overlook maybe some resource or consultation that could probably assist us. That, you know, if they're generous and wanting to be a part of the public process, and just a kind of system of getting some assistance from those folks who have things similar to us and who have gone through some of the troubleshooting and that we're faced with. And I think often we don't call on them and say, you know, hey, you know, on a, even non-gratis, can you come and assist us in this endeavor? And so I raise that because I'm sure that the private sector has had to go through some of the same obstacles and problems that we're talking about.
Yes, in fact... The Information Technology Executive Committee on the previous page, the ITEC, is about to transition into what's called the IRM Council, the Information Resources Management Council, which I believe is called for in statute. And I know that that statute calls for some private sector members of that IRM Council, which is are supposed to help advise the state on some of the things you're talking about.
I think I'm getting, I would like to get even a little closer than that. I did have a conversation with Peter in the governor's office yesterday of the of looking at perhaps getting a company to do what we did in the McCall years, where companies actually came in and sat side by side with us to help us figure out certain problems and to help us work through some issues, particularly when we went through the initial creation of the Department of Human Services and some of the other reform changes that the state was going through at the time. Businesses did step up and say, you know, we're perfect. We will come in, sit side by side with your staff, and assist you in making some of these transitions.
Good idea. I put on page 4 and then page 5 just a couple of graphs to give you some sense of the growth of all this. And in terms of storage space, our storage space in our, again, our central computer center has gone up about ninefold in the past 6 years, from half a terabyte to 4.5 terabytes. And our online transactions, I mentioned those 5.7 million a day, they've more than doubled in that same period of time. And over onto page 5, the number of desktop computers that we have on our network has gone up by 32% in that time, from 6,500 to 9,500, although if you look at the one in the...
That correlates with your staff.
Madam Chair, part of it is as we've built some of these newer systems that serve as somewhat as front ends to some of those old mainframe systems, we've had more people using them. And part of it, 1,000 of that, is reflected in that chart at the bottom, which is the number of so-called terminals, as some people impolitely call them, dumb terminals, not personal computers, that were the things with the green screens that were around for decades. And those have been reduced by about 1,000 during that same time and pretty much replaced by personal computers.
But on your network desktop computers, you have 9,500 of them in O3. And how many employees?
Oh, I'm sorry. That's about the same. Yes.
It's about the same.
Yes.
So practically every employee has a computer.
Practically, there are, Madam Chair, there are some in institutions like the mental hospitals that would not. But the reason that that number is where it is we have also in some of the self-sufficiency offices, we have PCs that clients use in their work to get jobs and to do resumes and things like that. So there, it's not quite one for one. There are some where we have extras that are in those offices or things like that.
What question, how frequently do you replace your computers?
Madam Chair, that's a point I was going to make a little later, and I'll make it right now. The industry standard for replacement of personal computers is 3 to 4 years, and we had settled about 2 years ago that we would try to do it in 4 years, and reductions in budget here this last 6 or 8 months have got us to a point where we're probably talking more than 6 years as a replacement cycle for those for the personal computers now.
And what do you do with the computers that you no longer use?
The first thing we do is we look to see if we have a better use for them in the department. One of the things that has happened in the past as the divisional approach to doing this stuff was in place is that you'd often have one division surplusing faster machines than another division was using. And so as we've brought this together, especially over the last 2 or 3 years, we've now the first thing we do if somebody doesn't need a PC is we look to see if it can be used in the department and possibly replace an older, slower one. And then after that, they get turned over to the Department of Administrative Services as part of surplus. Yes. Another thing on, if I could move along here on page 6, I don't propose to talk about this, but I put this in. I call this the spaghetti chart. And this is an attempt to show the relationships between the various major programs of the department. For instance, you'll see medical assistance over on the top right and public health over on the top left, and the major information systems that serve those programs and the relationships that they have within with each other, and interfaces and exchanges of data and that sort of stuff.
You're still showing the Oregon Youth Authority, or are they still inside of your...
Madam Chair, the Oregon Youth Authority, of course, is not part of the department, but they still run stuff on our mainframe, as does the Employment Department, which is used to be part of the department.
They get a better federal match than you do. Why is that?
I don't know. That's a good question. I don't know. Although I'll tell you, if they get a better federal match than us, I'd sure like to figure out a way to tap some of their funds.
You're getting 90-10, aren't you? What are you getting on your match?
Madam Chair, it depends on the program. For the new development in Medicaid, we get 90-10. And so a number of the things like the MMIS that we're going to talk about later is 90-10, and some of the other ones are. But a lot of our other ones only get 50-50 for operations, or 75% in the case of Medicaid for operations. It just varies depending on the program. And a few of them, like women's infants and children, which is another one of our policy packages, is actually 100%.
That means women have a higher priority.
Absolutely. If I can move to page 7. One of the other things that we use on a regular basis in the way of reports to help us manage our organization are our performance measures. And one of the things we do is an annual customer satisfaction survey, which has a pretty fair amount of detail, but the one statistic I want to cite for you is that in people who said they were either very satisfied or satisfied with our services, in 2001 it was 67%, and it went up to 80% in 2002. And so we've seen an improvement in that over the years, and still have a ways to go, but that's encouraging. And that's one of the things that we use, and some of the detail from that, to help us manage the organization. I just put here, I don't propose, in the interest of time, unless you want me to spend a lot of time on these organizational units. And let me just, if I can, try to give you a couple of sentences on each. Our technology and strategy group is basically the group that helps us do our future planning. They do R&D on new products that we may want to start using.
How many do you have in that group?
9. Very small. And that group develops our policies, and they work on process improvement and that sort of stuff. The Information Systems Engineering Group, which is responsible for maintaining all of our existing applications and helping us develop new ones, is that's their major activity, and they help us with all those acronyms down there, which I won't speak or it'll cost me money. And they maintain about 8,000 programs, computer programs, with those 13 million lines of mainframe code that I mentioned earlier.
And how many is that?
I'm gonna get my sheet out, if you don't mind, and just so I can... And the next one is our computing, what we call computing resource management. That's the one that Senator Morris asked Clyde about, and that's our group that manages our mainframe and our central servers, and that's the one that's in the employment building. And by the way, Madam Chair, it occurred to me, I wondered if maybe the employment building you were referring to, was that the one that's catty-cornered our building there at Summer?
The newer building.
So the one right catty-cornered at Summer and Union?
You have one that's just a branch, and then the other one is
the main one.
The main one.
Yeah, okay. That's the one.
That's the one I had problems getting in.
Yeah. That's where our mainframe is, and that's where our computer center is in that building. And we have 32. And they, as I say, they run our mainframe and the central servers, and they maintain our large centralized databases, and that's the operation that runs 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And then the last major one I want to mention is our network and desktop services, and I want to mention another couple of performance measures around this one. They operate our wide area network, which is what connects our offices all over the state. They also support our local area networks, which are in each of our offices that connect people within the office to each other and ultimately hook them into that wide area network, which sends their stuff around the state. They also work on security, which I'm going to talk about as one of our challenges, and they manage our help desk. And a couple of performance measures related to all of that. We've been tracking our problem resolution, which we get on a monthly basis, and which means when somebody contacts us with a problem using a system, maybe their PC is broken, maybe the network's down, or their software isn't working, or whatever. In 2001, our problem resolution average was 4.1 days. And it's in 2002 down to 2.9 days. And this, remember, is an average. And some of that may be, the length of some of that may be because a part had to be ordered. We have priorities where if a section of the state is down, that has a higher priority than if an office is down. And if an office is down, that's higher than if part of an office or a group of people's down are down. If somebody has a printer that's out, if they have another way in their office to get printing done, that may be a much lower priority than somebody whose PC is gone and they can't work at all. So sometimes it takes us longer to do things in certain areas than in other areas, and so that's why that average is what it is. And one of the things I'm going to want to talk to you about a little later is the fact to give you some information about how under-resourced we are in general, which I think relates to those levels of service. Another thing I want to mention about the help desk, and that really is our single point of contact for users. When a user has a problem, they call the help desk, and the help desk tries to either resolve it on the spot or they refer it to somebody who has expertise that they may not have. They handle about 4,600 calls a month. The performance measure related to the help desk is in 2001, the number, and the help desk has been doing surveys of our its people who use its services for years. 2001, 68% said they were very satisfied, and in 2002, 72% said they were very satisfied with the help desk services. And all of that, when that same period of time, moving from 68% to 72%, the number of calls per month went from 3,650 to almost 4,400 calls in 2001 and 2002. So while the calls were going up, which means they had more work to do, the customer satisfaction was also going up.
What were the type of consistent problems that were identified and noted of the 4,600 calls?
Madam Chair, I don't have that at my fingertips. I can tell you that a lot of what they have are problems using the applications that are specifically, that serve specific programs. Like somebody will have problems using the applications that serve the old Adult and Family Services Division or the server cluster. Often it is, yes. Often. What I'd like to do now,
can you tell
if
me how many staff are in the network and desk?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, 90.
Senator Morse.
Madam Chair, thank you. Maybe this would be a good place to explain why the website development is not in this department.
Sure, Madam Chair and Senator Morse, we do two different kinds of web activities. We are just beginning to develop actual applications that use the web for what I'll loosely call business transactions. And we're just getting into that now. And that stuff is clearly heavily technology-driven. You have to have, or oriented, you have to have people who understand web development and web software, Java and stuff like that, software web languages. And that stuff is in my organization. The other kind of web stuff we have are what are called static web pages, which are informational pages where somebody goes out and all they're doing is navigating between this page that has this kind of information on it, and maybe they go to another page which gives them something different, but they're not really doing any interactive transactions. And those static web pages, and the department has thousands of them, and the state, I heard this number the other day and I can't remember, it was pretty startling. The state has 1 million web pages, static web, something, it was startling, the number, and I don't remember it now. But those static web pages really, those really are user stuff, where the users just go out and they put information on those web pages. They don't take a lot of heavy technical knowledge. And so a decision was made in the department to take the work on the static web pages, and it had been scattered all over the department, and it was buried in all kinds of funny places, to start to bring that together and to put that into the communications group. So they actually do, and that's heavily content-oriented, so they do the work on the content on those static web pages. Now, we still support the technology that they use. We support the network, and we support their desktop personal computers, and the software that they use and that sort of stuff, but the actual work of building those static web pages, it was felt in the department, made more sense for the people who were closer to the content to do that than for the technology people to do that. And just one last thing, and by the way, the stuff that I mentioned first, the interactive applications that use the web, those are still driven by business needs. When we develop an application like that, we're still working with the clusters, whichever ones they are, who have a business need, and we're working with them for them to define those business needs and tell us how that application should work, whether this transaction goes here or there or how that sort of thing happens. So that's why we've separated those.
Follow up.
Good question. Thank you. The interactive versus static, Isn't the trend to go all interactive? And,
yes.
And if we're continuing to develop static websites and invest in that activity, aren't we beating a dead horse?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, that's a good question. I'm not sure I have a good answer because, again, those kinds of choices are made by the business folks. Where we are moving toward interactive stuff, we do it. As long as they're still maintaining those static pages, I mean, those things, some of those will be around forever, where you don't need to go interactive. You just need to present information to somebody, and they go and look it up. But that's really a choice of the business as to how they want to use the web, and we try to respond accordingly. I guess one other thing I'd say about that, too, is that there had been, and in fact, the Department of Administrative Services has been trying to get into the game of hosting those static web pages for the state. They haven't gotten at least far enough along for us to do a lot with them yet. We do some. They do host a number of our web pages. That's probably where it's moving more likely, is toward centralizing it in the Department of Administrative Services rather than pulling it out of our communications group.
An opportunity for improvement.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah. And just to go back to opportunities, when you looking at the number of user calls, what's your process of working with the rest of the agencies as with respect to training? Because if you're getting an increase in the number of user calls per month, that suggests that perhaps training has not taken place someplace. If the majority of them are about applications, that suggests to me that you can reduce the number of user calls per month. Your job should be, I mean, somebody's job should be talking about to reduce the frequencies of those calls. how, where inside of the system does that take place?
Madam Chair, we have just recently installed some new help desk software that we use to manage the activities of the help desk and when the calls come in and to communicate with users about where the what the status of their of the work on their problem is. And one of the things that we're going to get out of that new software that will be a lot better for us is exactly what you're talking about. We'll be able to start taking that information and creating profiles and being able to go back to the business side of the department and say, yeah, we see.
So currently you don't have a profile?
Not much, no. The software we had been using didn't make it very easy to do that.
So most of the stuff is anecdotal from your staff?
Yes.
That there is perceived, I think staff pretty much can have a good indication of what the calls that they're receiving and what they're about, whether they're not out in the field, that there's a need in a particular branch or a particular location of training.
Yes, that's absolutely right, Madam Chair. And that's how it works right now. Pretty anecdotal, and we're hoping the new software will help us make it a little less anecdotal and a little more structured.
There's another opportunity. Thank you.
Okay, if I could, moving on to page 8, I'd like to talk for a bit about some of the things, the challenges that we face. First of all, I mentioned this a few minutes ago. In the department, and this is true, I think, across state government, information technology is pretty significantly under-resourced. If you take a look and the information we've got, the comparative information, comes from Gartner Group, which is the state's contracted provider of information of this sort, and they're an international company that tracks industry trends and does consulting and that sort of stuff. And our expenditures compared to the average for state government agencies in 2002, the average agency spent about $4.10 out of every $100 budgeted. We spent $1.30.
Can you give me this, how that comparison is with, let's say, our neighbor to the north and our neighbor to the south?
Madam Chair, I do not know.
You don't know?
No.
Senator Morrison and Representative West.
Thank you. What is the budget of dollars? Is that $8.7 billion, or is that for every $100 budgeted? Is that the global number for DHS? Is that the, or what would be the $100 times X equals?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris, I'm not positive about that. I'd like to get back to you for sure about that one. I believe that that's the total agency budget.
In comparison to what, though?
But as a follow-up, it would be almost equal to the total central support budget. If, by my calculation, using $8.7 billion, that's $356 million.
Again, I need to get back to you with specifically how that works. I don't have that in my head. That's a good question. I don't.
Representative Weston?
That's how I would have calculated that as well. But my question, John, you've got averages here. DHS spent $1.30 out of every 100. Would the median calculation be significantly different? In other words, do you have one state that is pulling this either way up or way down?
Madam Chair and Representative Westland, a good question. I'm not sure I can give you a specific answer, and if you don't mind, I'd like to
take a look on it. But I mean, if there's some other,
yeah.
I mean, you know, if the median and the average are close, then these
sure.
numbers are representative.
Sure.
You know, if it's not, then there's
fair enough. Yeah.
I would say, John, on all of your medians where you've used the average state agency, 7 out of every 50 employees worked, and here again, the median of what? And when you're doing a national comparison, what's the... what's the range?
Yeah, Madam Chair, and those are good questions, and I can I'll try to get some more specifics. I mean, this is something that we got from a Gartner Group report, and the people who put it together for me thought it was relevant, but I'll make sure that I get you some specifics.
Senator Morris.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To me, the most important thing that would come out of that Gartner group would be what's the benchmark? Is there a state agency that has utilized the best technology, the best outsourcing, the best mm-hmm. design, the highest deliverables at the least cost? What is the benchmark? And is there, in fact, a benchmark mm-hmm. of the 50 states that we have? To me, that would be the most important piece of information. What's our goal? Our goal certainly isn't to increase our costs by $200 million.
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
And that's the inference of sure. where we should be.
Well, and if I could comment, that's a good, Madam Chair and Senator Morris, I think that is a good question. I don't know that we can get that from Gartner Group, but again, we'll look and see what they do. A survey, which is where this stuff comes from. And but I'm not implying that we ought to increase these resources. I'm just trying to help you all understand that this is pretty thin to begin with.
Well, I think
and it has to do with service levels.
I think for when you say pretty thin, go back to it. I'll piggyback on Senator Morris. It's against what? If you don't know what is the standard in the universe, who is the best in those benchmarks, then you mm-hmm. can't get to the thinning level without knowing what is the best with inside the systems. And I think that's what the good senator is saying.
Yes.
Well,
and that's
it's very clear to me, Madam Chair, that going back to your page 3, and the old systems that we have, I mean, we're on the verge of just it isn't going to work in the future the way it's designed. So where do we need to go, and what should be the budgeting? And I know that there's a lot of work with your information technology executive committee, and all that's probably processing all this. But from a budget standpoint, you know, where are we going?
And Madam Chair and Senator Morris, that really is something that the state as a whole is trying to get its arms around. And I know that there are a number of conversations with other legislators about that, and I think you as well, if I remember correctly.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I think those are questions that are long overdue for being asked, and we need to figure this stuff out, because some of these systems are not just the case in this agency, but throughout the state are
right.
pertinent. Mm-hmm. Well, at the risk on page 9 of having several of you raise the same questions again, let me also say that there are some other comparisons here about, I'm bearing in mind the question about average, so I won't bother to mention those. You can read those as well as I can speak them. And but I did mention the second item on the top of, up there toward the top of page 9, is that our personal computer replacement cycle is now at more than 6 years, and against an industry standard of 3 to 4 years, and we had selected 4. And one of the things I'm going to talk about a little bit later is that, you know, in the problem you have in
industry standard, are you talking about like Hewlett Packard, and are you talking about the user side?
Madam Chair, this is again a Gartner Group number where they're saying, if you think about the pace of technical change and how long computers stay current before they become obsolete personal computers, that in organizations they ought to be replaced every 3 to 4 years, and we pick the higher end of that.
Do they also take into consideration the usage?
Yes. Yeah, sure. Yes. The problem, and as I said, I was going to mention this a little later, but I'll say it now. One of the problems is you can't stand still in this stuff because the vendors won't let you. The vendors are constantly changing software, bringing out new software. They won't support old software, and you gradually get out of sync with, you want to get a product, even bringing it in from somebody else, where you have to use a particular level of software like Microsoft Office 97 versus Microsoft Office 2000 versus Microsoft Office XP, which is the current version of Microsoft Office. And so the vendors really part of their strategy, and I don't blame them. I've been on the vendor side for a number of years, and I know how this works. The vendor strategy is to continue to replace this stuff to force, ultimately, to force upgrades in both software and hardware. And so you really, you can't stand still for very long just because of the way that it works in the industry.
Senator Morris.
There's a bill in the House that deals with open sourcing. Yeah. Has the state taken a position on that?
Madam Chair and Senator Morris, I don't know if the state has taken a position on that. In fact, on page, I think it's 11, well, somewhere down here, I was going to talk about open source. And it, maybe I can talk about it now for a minute. Open source is, there's been a move afoot to, and it started as kind of a grassroots thing where somebody developed a piece of software and sort of put it out for everybody to use for free and said, anybody who uses it, your obligation is if you make a change in it that improves it, you have to make it available to everybody else. So it's this sort of consortium of people who are supporting this so-called open source software in a very open way, and so anybody can get that software and use it for free. The most notable example of open source software is something called Linux, which is an operating system, L-I-N-U-X, which is an operating system that actually has taken over a lot of server operating system activity around the world. And Linux is an example of open source. There are some companies like Red Hat that sell some versions of Linux that they will now support as a company, and they sort of wrap some products that are still around this open source thing. I know people who are using Linux on PCs who say it's just fine, and it's free. Now, you may not want to get something that's that free because you got nobody to support it. You have to invest more money to support it. In our case, putting Linux on our PCs instead of Windows would mean that a lot of our applications that use PCs, that have part of the software on the PC, we would have to rewrite it to run under Linux as opposed to running under Windows. So it's not quite as free as it seems, but it has an awful lot of appeal. One of the things that we as an agency have looked at is a version of open source which is called Star Office, which is actually a product of Sun Microsystems, which is a big technology company. And that there's a version of Star Office called Open Office, which is the open source version of that. And we've done some looking. I know other agencies have looked at some of that too. Personally, I would say that I think open source for an organization like ours is probably pretty risky, but I think there are increasingly these sort of open source things like Star Office that we really ought to be looking at because of the potential for significant cost savings. Frankly, what you get with Microsoft is you're paying an enormous amount of money for all that development of those bells and whistles that very few people use. I mean, I use Microsoft Office, used it for years, and most of those features in Microsoft Word I don't use. But they bring out a new version that has even more features that I won't use, and you're paying for it. So, I mean, it's attractive, but I think we have to be pretty careful about Open Office. I'm not, or open source, I mean, I'm not real sure where that bill is and what the state's position is on it, to answer your question directly.
Please continue.
Another issue, another challenge that we face is the graying workforce. And if you take a close look at me, you will see that I'm one of the folks who falls into that category. According to the Gartner Group, about 75% of government agencies are going to face shortages of qualified IT staff over the next 4 or 5 years. of the state agencies that Gartner surveyed, 86% said that more than 11% of their IT staff are going to be eligible to retire in the next 5 years. And the worst shortages for IT staff will be in the higher skill levels, the really specialized technical skills. In our organization, about 15% of our staff will be eligible to retire by the end of calendar year 2004, in about 18 months. I know that there's been a lot of stuff in the press over the last 4 or 5 years predicting shortages nationwide of hundreds of thousands of technical staff, people with technical skills. I haven't seen much of that lately with some of the downturn in the economy and the dot-com bust and some of that. That may not be quite as bad as it had been because there may be more people available. But we're still finding in our hiring of high-level skills, we're still having problems because they're hard to come by and they're expensive. And not only are we going to have to deal...
Cuddy, if we could stop you there. Senator Morse.
Thank you. What would be, in terms of your high-level skills, what would be a base salary in today's market?
For us?
Yeah.
I'm sorry, for us, Madam Chair and Senator Morse. Oh, you're talking in the 60s and low 70s.
And what would be the private side?
Oh, six figures for some of those folks.
Mm-hmm.
100, 100 and a quarter, maybe even 150 for some of the really heavy database analysts and people who have the web designers in high demand right now because, as you said earlier, so many people were moving toward that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we in our lower levels it's a lot easier, but there are eight classification levels for technical people, IS1 through 8. And when we start getting into the 5, 6, 7, and 8, we start having comparative salary problems, especially badly.
Thank you.
So not only do we have to deal with normal turnover, but we have to deal with this potential, too, of the about 15% of our folks could leave within the next 18, 20 months. And I sort of alluded to this, the financial crisis that you all know all too well, much better than I in many ways, and I know you're wrestling with it, and the talk about potential reduction in employee benefits makes that salary differential problem potentially even worse for us. We're trying as much as we can to grow our existing IT staff through better training. We've tried to make a significant investment in training, although, again, as resources get tighter and tighter, that gets tougher and tougher. We're trying to do some mentoring of some of our folks, particularly some of our lower-level managers, to help them grow. Trying to do sort of more of a grow-your-own thing as much as we can with some of our newer people. One of the unfortunate problems we have is that a lot of those newer skills that we need to do web stuff and things like that come from people who haven't been with us very long, and if we get into a staff reduction situation, they may be some of the first that we'd have to let go because they have the least seniority, and the people who have, ironically, the most seniority are the ones who are keeping an eye on those old mainframe 20- and 30-year-old systems. But that's just kind of a fact of life, and I'm not complaining. I'm just trying to mention that's just something we have to deal with and live with. Trying to be more aggressive with recruiting, but, again, it's this stuff is all market driven, and it's tough to do that. We have seen, because of the economic downturn in some of our jobs, we're getting more and better applicants, and so that's helped us. But I suspect when the economy turns back up, which we all got our fingers crossed it will one day soon, maybe even is now, some of that we're seeing in our recruiting, we expect that we're not going to get as many qualified applicants. And another thing that we've done for years, and continue to do strategically wherever it makes sense to us is we're trying to do some outsourcing. I'm going to talk a little about outsourcing later and mention some of the areas where we are doing some of that, and we, where appropriate, contract for technical staff. We have vendors who do projects for us. We buy staff skills and that sort of stuff on the open market. That helps us to get some of those technical people, but we, the highly skilled technical people, we have to pay for them. They're expensive. Moving on, another thing I'd like to talk about, if I can, is what I call single client view, or some people say single client record. What we're really talking about here is the need for a some sort of a combined or consolidated view of information about services that clients get and about their demographic information and that sort of stuff. One of the results of this, all these systems that were developed independently for all these years, is we have all kinds of data about clients that sometimes isn't consistent. We'll have more than one address about somebody, or pieces of information about them are not always the same in every one of our systems. And I will tell you that for many, many years, maybe decades, having a single client view or a single client record has been a holy grail that everybody's been after. People in my, ever since I walked in the door in the department, in this department, people have been asking for that, and rightfully so. And we're trying to get to do some things that are moving us in that direction. It is, and agencies all over the country are trying to get to that single client record, but there's not many of them that I'm aware of that have gotten very far with it. The
what are the major obstacles to keep you from getting there?
Madam Chair, a number of things. Data is not consistently defined, and in fact, one of the things that we're have been working to expand some lately is a thing we call our client index. And that was begun about 10 years ago, and we've just started to put expanded it to include child welfare information. And I brought, to give you some sense of the data problem, some examples of some of the issues we've run into around the client index. One of them is around ethnicity codes. Different program areas have used different sets of codes, some of them provided by federal guidelines for ethnicity. And we can try to build in some automated ways of combining those and sort of crosswalking them. But a number of those crosswalks need to be done by hand. I'm told that an example is the use of South Pacific Islander. And, again, I'm not sure why that specifically is a problem, but that's one of the things that was mentioned to me. Another one is Social Security number. Not all the program areas use Social Security number or require it, but and also there are privacy questions around our ability to use Social Security number as an identifier. We have to get clients' permission. Some of the programs in the past, when a child came along.
I need to ask a question, yep. Because some of these things, I know that it's required. You know, you say you have to get the client's permission, but when you go into the hospital and in the part of the permission process, you sign to say that you give them permission to do certain things or the other. And it has always troubled me that in our field of endeavor, that we don't model what we're doing after the hospital and medical community. And they're a good one to look at the data. Their data is just as much, is just as complex. The questions that they ask are, you know, pretty much no different than what we ask. They have multiple pieces that have to go into into the client system. For example, they may come in and have surgery. They have to go to X-ray. They have to go to lab. You have all these various pieces. And I've always, having come from that side a lot of years ago, it's always been interesting to me why we cannot take that particular kind of process and use it for human services. It's just really baffling when you talk about a central intake system to where, you know, you're talking about fundamentally name, age, address, social security, you know, those kinds of things, and why we can't get there.
I can cite you one, Madam Chair, one.
Grail.
Yeah, well, it's mine too. I can cite you one very concrete example, Allegheny County, Pennsylvania, which is Pittsburgh. I'm told had a major consulting firm help them create what's called a data warehouse, which is where you start to bring a lot of this information together. It took them 6 months to agree on the definition of a client.
Well,
among their different programs. And some of this stuff is just incompatible. It's cultural. It has to do with history of how this stuff was put together 10, 20, 30 years ago.
We've been trying for 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I believe them.
Well, I know we have.
Yeah.
You know, I was here when we created the department, and we've been trying for 30 years. And so, how long does it take to change a culture? You know, anyway, that's one of my extreme frustrations. You know, we did the prototype back when I was with Model Cities in 1968 or 69, and here we are. It's been more than 30 years. My calculations are off. And in the creation of the department, undergirding that was talking about integrated service systems. When we started the Albina Center in Portland, it was to have, quote, a integrated system. And I suspect if I go up to Albina right now, you don't have anywhere close to an integrated system. And, you know, and we keep talking about it. First, it was confidentiality, and confidentiality raises head so many times. And when we don't want to do something, we say the feds say. And I find it interesting how the hospitals can get around that particular issue, and we cannot. And I would like for us to begin to spend some time in answering that fundamental question of how can we have another entity like the hospitals who have been doing this fundamentally for years. When I was a medical record librarian up on the hill, we have a single record that goes to multiple places, including goes outside of the state system to the Veterans Hospital. And yet you can provide that kind of a document, and I'm certain today in high technology that they're probably on information systems that they no longer are doing that manual kind of work that they did when I was there a lot of years ago. Under that Dewey Decimal System, by the way, is the system that's done in the hospitals. So I raise that because I would like for Oregon maybe to be the pioneer to show the rest of the nation how we can do this. You know, how really can we get this done for the, you know, not just for the benefit of efficiencies, but for the benefit of our customers whom we serve. With that, Representative Weston, would you like to have some comments?
Well, I think the answer to your question about the integration of the system. First of all, I could not agree with you more. And secondly, I think the answer to that question lies in the same reason that we have 2,700 forms in the department.
Yeah.
That's down from what, Clyde? I know you've been working.
3,100.
Probably about 3,100.
But actually, the interesting thing is that if you have a system set up, that where it's centralized, the field staff could not develop forms. In medical records, you have what is required under each one of the various departments, and you're not going to get somebody to slide in something that had not come out from that particular organization to insert into a record. And that's part of the control, you know, but it's also where when you're talking about if you're going to allow everyone into your system to create, then they're going to create. We all like to have our name on
right.
something.
Right.
We're all, you know, it's the pride of authorship out there in the world. And that's why it's difficult to take it away because it's for my own utility and it's mine. Thank you very much. And tomorrow we will do the the mass system, right? And she's giving me my note to my cheat sheet. Tomorrow we'll finish up the information system, including the MMIS discussion. And we will need to wrap up the department-wide services tomorrow. And so tomorrow we need to get your particular testimony over in about an hour. So Margie, I can get you in and get you wrapped up. And then I'm assuming that Jean will be back so that she can do the department wrap-up. And so the rest of them aren't here because they had good news. That means that on Friday we have full. But on Monday and Tuesday, if we get everything wrapped up tomorrow, you guys can have a day or two off while I work with staff on getting ready for rebalance on Wednesday and Thursday. So is that good news?
I was going to suggest we go to work session on Monday.
He's just full of it.
Madam Chair, could I ask that your record show that...
My records will show that Rosie and Rosette enjoys and relishes the contribution that are being made today to the Oregon Food Bank.
My pleasure.
With that, we are adjourned.